This call is being recorded.
And like I said in my email, the goal of recording this call is to put us in a position to share the audio and a transcript on our website after the call. If you say anything that you'd prefer be cut from the recording or the transcript, don't hesitate to let me know. There's no problem at all to do that after the fact. We have a real small call, so hopefully we'll be able to have some discussion, answer some questions. Some of you emailed in questions to me already, which I'm happy to raise and answer myself. But if others have questions that they want to ask, I think that would be great so we can have a little bit more discussion rather than just hearing me talk for a while. So I am going to start with a very brief overview of some of the main things that we thought about in our research process this year and some of the key points about our top charities. And so it'll probably be just me talking for the next 5 or 10 minutes. But then after that, I'd really like to turn it over to you and hear what questions you have on your minds. And one of the things that we know is that the content on our website can be dense and sometimes hard to parse. And so I'd really encourage you to ask whatever questions are on your mind, even if they are very basic, about very basic topics that you think probably are covered somewhere in the written materials that we've put out. I'd love to use this time to try and answer some of the questions that you're still wondering about and just haven't been able to track down the answers to. So with that, let me dive into some of the summary content about our top charities. So, you know, this year we did more work on our top charities research than we have in recent years, and that was really a function of increasing the size of our staff. And so wherein for the past few years, our recommended charities have stayed, you know, with small differences, relatively constant. This year, we added 4 totally new organizations to our list and continued to update past top charities. And, you know, for that, we're really grateful to the support of the donors who have given us the ability to expand the staff that we have devoted to our research. In general, the way that GiveWell's process works is that we first identify interventions that we think have very strong evidence of effectiveness and cost effectiveness, and then we do a deep investigation of those interventions, distinct from any individual charity. So, for example, that's an assessment of the effectiveness of deworming, independent of whether it's implemented by SCI or Deworm the World, 2 of our top charities. And it's only after we've completed that investigation of the program, the intervention, that we look for charities that are implementing that intervention in a high quality and robust way. And so a lot of what the intervention is really the starting point for much of our research, and that's why so much of the content that we put out focuses on the intervention sort of level questions. And so with that in mind, I want to talk about a brief overview of our top organizations this year. I think the best thing to reference for our 4 highest rated charities is the summary table that's near the end of the blog post that we put out last Monday, which compares AMF, Deworm the World, GiveDirectly, and SCI along 6 dimensions that are all relevant to our view of how to recommend them. And so I would like to, now I'm just going to go through very quickly each of the organizations in turn with the ways in which they stand out the most. So on one end of the spectrum, there's Deworm the World Initiative, and where they really stand out is our best estimate for their cost effectiveness. And these cost effectiveness estimates are ones that are extremely rough and subject to a great deal of judgment calls. But, you know, our best guess is that, you know, they are roughly 10 to 20 times as cost effective as GiveDirectly and 2 to 4 times as cost effective as AMF and SCI. And so Deworm the World really stands out for the, you know, potential cost effectiveness. On the other side of things, we think they have the smallest room for more funding of any of the top charities we recommend. Their total funding gap that they're looking for additional unrestricted donations is $1.3 million over the next 2 years. And so while they're extremely cost effective, the need for funding is much smaller. And I think what they are raising funds for is roughly a third to maintain and scale up their operations, and two-thirds for policy-relevant research projects. And we wrote a long blog post a couple weeks ago going into the detail about that. So that's DWORM, the world, and where they stand out. AMF, the Against Malaria Foundation, which distributes bed nets to prevent malaria, they are extremely cost-effective. So we think they're not quite as cost-effective as DWORM the world, but significantly more cost-effective than GiveDirectly. They are strong on virtually all the criteria that we have, and they have a great deal of room for more funding. I think the main Against Malaria Foundation is an interesting case because we recommended them for a few years from 2011 to 2013, and then we took them down last year after they struggled to get funding out the door. We felt they had enough money in the bank to maintain their operations and find new distribution. And now we've returned them. But I think the Against Malaria Foundation is the question mark for them is whether they'll be able to continue to successfully identify new distributions. We're optimistic about it, but given their track record is not quite as strong as the other organizations on this list at executing successfully on the programs that they have. The third organization on our list, and these are not in any particular order that I'm going through them. So the third that I'm going to talk about is SCI, the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, which also runs a deworming program to treat children for parasitic infections. They are very cost-effective, similar to AMF, about 5 to 10 times as cost-effective as cash. With SCI, I think there's two major questions to be thinking about. One is that they have, in our view, relatively limited room for more funding once all the donors who we expect to be supporting them end up giving. And those are donors who are, to some extent, influenced by GiveWell and to some extent not. We roughly think that SCI has about $1 million of additional funding gap remaining for this year after those donations come through. And so that's significantly smaller than AMF, whose funding gap we think is at around $5 million. SCI is also the organization that we've had the most difficulty communicating with over the years. And what I mean by that is we have asked, and this comes through in our review, and it's detailed there, but I think the short story is that we've asked questions where we don't always feel that the answers are convincing and compelling and stay constant over time. It's sometimes the answers to our questions, sometimes seem to shift. And so SCI is an organization where they run a proven program. They appear to have a strong track record of implementing that program globally, but we don't feel as comfortable with, and we are not as knowledgeable about the specific things that they're doing and how well they're going. And I'm certainly happy to get into more detail on SCI if anyone's interested in them. And then finally, I want to talk about GiveDirectly. So GiveDirectly distributes cash to very poor people in the developing world, and they're an organization that we see sort of as the, and I've been talking about them as the benchmark against which to assess the other organization's cost effectiveness. So they are 10 to 20 times less cost effective in our estimation than DWORM the World, 5 to 10 times less so than AMF and SCI. Again, those estimates are really more guesses and very rough estimates than they are highly credible views of the differences in the impacts they're having. And so on that front, GiveDirectly is that's their weakness, so to speak. On pretty much all the other factors, we see them as the strongest organization we know of, and significantly so. I mean, they have continued to produce high quality monitoring of their activities and shared significant information with us about what they're doing and how well it's going. And so we continue to believe that they're an outstanding option, and in some ways the organization that is the most similar to the type of organization we would have wanted to see created, that we were looking to exist when we started GiveWell 7 years ago. So that's a very brief overview of those organizations. I want to quickly touch on are four other charities, the standouts. And, you know, these are organizations that right now we don't rate as highly as our top organizations, but we think that with additional time and additional research, all of them could end up being on our top rated list. And any donor who, a donor who has somewhat different values or intuitions about how to weigh different factors, be it cost effectiveness or organizational upside or organizational competence, you know, all of these things could lead someone to choose to give to one of the standouts relative to our top charities. So very briefly, two of the organizations on our standout list run a program called salt iodization. And there's very strong evidence that when we fortify salt with iodine, it improves children's cognitive development. And this was true in a very large way when people were severely iodine deficient, which was the case in parts of the developing world 50 years ago. Now it appears that children are more likely to be only moderately deficient rather than severely deficient, but the effects on IQ, as measured by in randomized controlled trials, have remained strong, even in areas where people are only moderately deficient. And therefore, we see this as it's an incredibly cheap way to improve the cognitive development of children. Both of these organizations neither of these organizations, I should say, works to directly implement salt iodization. They're not literally in factories putting the iodine in salt. Instead, they are working with the government and with the salt industry to make salt iodization happen. And that can mean everything from advocating to the government to make it a priority to pass salt iodization legislation, to advising the government on how to conduct monitoring or regulatory enforcement, to even advising the salt industry on how they should be implementing this iodization to their to their company. And so these organizations are somewhat further from the bottom line delivery of the program, but nonetheless, and so we have had trouble so far identifying the demonstrable track record of their work. Nonetheless, the program is quite strong. I think the way they work is the way an organization would have to work to implement this type of program. And so we're excited to follow them, and they certainly seem potentially like very good donation options to us. The last two organizations, both are relatively small and stand out for having conducted or are for being in the middle of conducting randomized controlled trials of their programs. The first one that I'll mention is Development Media International, which we'll refer to as DMI. And they produce mass media broadcasts to try and change health behaviors in the developing world. So they'll produce a series of 15-minute narrative spots that focus around a health message, such as if your child has a fever, make sure to take them to the health clinic because it could be malaria and you really want to start them on the malaria treatment as soon as possible. So it'll range from 15-minute narratives that focus around an issue to a 60-minute commercial. And they're running a randomized control trial where they randomize 7 radio stations in Burkina Faso to transmit their messages and 7 not. And at the middle of their trial, they measured self-reported behavior and people reported moderate increases in the behaviors that DMI was targeting. Because they can reach so many people so cheaply through mass media, if they are effective at changing behavior, it's an incredibly cost-effective way to change behavior and save lives. And I think the real question about them is whether they are, the results in the trial are accurately identifying real behavior change as opposed to only self-reported behavior change. The final organization on our list is Living Goods, and they're an organization that also has conducted a randomized trial of their program. They run a network of what they call micro-entrepreneurs. So Living Goods sells health goods at wholesale prices to these micro-entrepreneurs, and the micro-entrepreneurs go door-to-door and sell health goods to households. And the idea is that the households will buy things like soap, malaria nets, deworming pills, vitamin A pills, and that this should solve a problem in global health, which is reaching the last mile, the people who live out in rural areas and don't have good access to health materials and health goods. And so in their randomized controlled trial, they found a 27% reduction in child mortality, which is an extremely strong result. When we did our cost effectiveness model of this, we came out with a cost per life saved of around $10,000. And so that was not in the same, that was not as strong as our, you know, as our top charities. And so that led us to be, to not put Living Goods at the highest end of our list. But we think that any organization that does what they do, you know, which is go out, run a randomized controlled trial, find a positive result. They were very public. I remember talking to them in 2009 when they were just getting started on the trial. They were very public about the fact that they wanted to monitor and assess the quality of their program. You know, I think it's an outstanding organization that, you know, offers some great opportunities to do a lot of good. Their goal is through this model of selling goods at wholesale prices to micro entrepreneurs to have a sustainable path for maintaining the delivery of health goods to rural areas. I think they're still pretty far away from achieving that goal. The money they bring in is about 10% of their total budget, I believe. And so they're not quite there yet. But I think if you were more optimistic about their path to sustainability, there would certainly be an argument for supporting them. And this is an argument that a development economist who reviewed our research back in 2010 made about Living Goods when he decided to support them. So that pretty much covers the summary that I wanted to make. And now I'd really like to turn it over to you all to see what questions you have. There's a couple ways that you can easily ask questions, and someone already sent in one question, which I'm happy to, you know, to kick things off with. But you can, what I'd encourage you to do is if you're on your computer, you can just, you know, type in the Uber conference chat window that you have a question and I can unmute the line, or you can just email me directly. And in most cases, looking at the screen here, I should be able to unmute you. But the ideal way that this would go is we'd use this call to answer the questions you have. And, you know, really, no matter how basic they are, I think this would be a great time to go through them. So I think what I'm going to do is I'll kick it off with the question that was emailed in, and then, you know, I'll leave it to you all to ask the questions that you have. So the question that was emailed in is about GiveDirectly, and it says that, you know, we have talked about, and I mentioned on this call that, you know, GiveDirectly stands out for the directness and robustness of Case for Impact, for their transparency and communication, for their ongoing monitoring. But, you know, they do worse on cost effectiveness. And it seems as if the ultimate thing that donors care about, the ultimate test, is cost effectiveness. So, you know, why is it that, you know, we care so much about these other factors when it comes to GiveDirectly, and we don't just focus on cost effectiveness? So, you know, this is a really good question. I think it's something that, you know, even people on GiveWell staff have different feelings about and different intuitions about how to weigh the different factors. The first and most important thing to know is I don't think that the cost effectiveness estimates that one is able to make for charities are sufficiently robust that one, you know, that they are necessarily worth putting so much weight on. And, you know, I think that In all of these cost effectiveness estimates, there are significant judgment calls that need to be made. And these judgment calls sometimes are things relate to philosophical values, and sometimes they relate to more concrete questions like how likely is it that a randomized controlled trial result will be replicated again? How likely is the result to be representative? How likely is the result from one location to be representative of another location? And so in our cost effectiveness models, we're trying to essentially incorporate all of that into one final number. And I think when you try to put all of those questions into one final number, you can sometimes be left with, you know, you're left with an output that is meaningful, but I don't think is sufficiently compelling to be the be-all and end-all of you know, of one's judgment. I think the best link that I think goes through this and sort of describes what we think, and I'll put it in the chat window there. It's a blog post Holden wrote about a little over a year ago called passive versus rational versus quantified. And the argument that it makes is that the charity recommendations we make, we don't intend to be fully quantified. There are judgments that go into them that are sometimes softer and rely on judgment. And our goal is to weigh all of these factors in reaching a final conclusion. So, you know, for an example, there's a fact about GiveDirectly that I think if something were to go wrong with GiveDirectly, we would be far more likely to find out about it much sooner than if something were to go wrong with SCI. I think if something were to go wrong with SCI, it's possible that we would never find out about it. And so in some ways, that to us is an indication that the bet on, you know, a sort of bet on GiveDirectly as an operation is a more robust one than a bet on SCI, because we're more confident that we have a full view of what's really happening, and we have the opportunity to learn ourselves from what happens with the organizations. So I hope I answered that question. Right now, we don't have any. No one else has asked any questions. I think what I'm going to do, so I'd encourage you to chat or send an email. If I don't get any more, I think what I'll do next is just unmute everyone, and it might get a little crazy, but at least that will put us in a position to have a little bit more conversation. All right. So we have a couple people with questions. Daniel, I just unmuted you, so you should be able to ask your question now.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ellie, for doing this. This is really helpful and fun to see the new recommendations. My question has to do with what people get from these various charities. So on top of just how much good we think they can accomplish with a marginal dollar in terms of the direct work we do, I'm also interested in unlocking new ways of doing charity, doing types of activities. And I wonder if you have a sense of which of these organizations are best positioned to experiment with or pilot or innovate with new types of approaches and learn sufficiently from those experiments that could actually change the way.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, you cut out a couple times, but I think I got most of the question. I'm gonna just mute you again quickly, and then I'll give you a chance to follow up afterwards. So the question is about, you know, aside from the direct impacts of marginal donations, which organizations have the ability to find new ways of doing things, or contribute to sort of the body of knowledge about. How to do aid most effectively. I'll answer that, and then Daniel, let me know if that didn't quite hit your question. I think that, I think in various ways, many of our organizations are well positioned to contribute to this. So I think it'll be easiest if I sort of run through the ones that I think may do this and in what ways. I think GiveDirectly is the first one that comes to mind. I think they are conducting research on cash transfers and trying to determine, you know, they are continuing to contribute to the evidence base on cash transfers. The most concrete way in which they're doing that right now, or the most important way, is via this very large scale randomized control trial they're raising money to run in Kenya. And this is a randomized control trial that I believe will enroll 15,000 participants in both the treatment and the control groups. And the goal of this trial is to measure the effects of cash transfers not only on individuals, which has been studied many times before, but on an economy as a whole, or at least on a much larger scale, to see what impacts do giving cash to so many people have on things like inflation, prices, work incentives that might be harder to measure when people kind of sporadically receive cash throughout an area and things might be happening. Negative economic effects could be occurring, but we might not be able to measure them given the relatively low density of the program in the whole area. So this is a very exciting trial. They also, I believe, intend to follow up with the participants long-term. And so that means we should have additional data on the long-term effects of cash transfers, for which we have some, but you know, still not as much as I think would be nice to have. This is a trial they're starting early next year, so that's, you know, that's one very concrete thing that GiveDirectly is doing. You know, I think more in some sense, I wouldn't say more importantly, but an area in which I think they are being very, you know, I see them as very promising, is that they are really running their operation in the way that I hope many other organizations would. And so I hope that many organizations would learn from what I don't know if it would make sense to call this, but the GiveDirectly model. And what I mean by that is a fewfold. You know, first, they picked a program that has strong evidence. Then when they run the program, they do significant monitoring to evaluate whether or not the program is working as it's intended. And the monitoring appears to be set up such that when things go wrong, they find it. So they had this example where because of the systems they had put in place, they were talking to recipients and determined that some low-ish level staff in Uganda had stolen money that was intended for the recipients. And their monitoring system identified it. They were able to then go in and fix the problem. And the level of monitoring that they are undertaking seems appropriate given their activity. And I wish that, you know, more organizations were sort of following their lead on being thoughtful about how to implement a monitoring system that, you know, contributed to how the organization actually ran by improving things when things go wrong. And then finally, this is another place where they do seem to stand out from most of the other organizations on our list. You know, they are trying to build a robust donor base that is independent of a GiveWell recommendation. And, you know, some of our other organizations are doing that to like one extent or, you know, to a greater or lesser extent. But it's and I know this is not directly responsive to the question that you had, but it is something that I think is, you know, is important and is different about them than many of the other organizations on our list, because they are, you know, trying to become a sustainable operation that doesn't just rely on a few large donors. I think other things equal, that type of, you know, I think that there could be reasons to operate another way, but that's certainly it's attractive to us that there's that sort of long-term vision that they may be able to, you know, raise significant funds from elsewhere. So anyhow, I know the last point about GiveDirectly was a little off topic. To sort of go through the others, you know, I don't think of SCI as doing very much of this. They do operational research. I don't personally know very much, and I don't believe we know very much about what they've learned. So I think it's appropriate to think of SCI more directly as money going to deworming people. Then there's, you know, Deworm the World. So Deworm the World is a program that's part of a larger organization called Evidence Action. I think that Deworm the World is, you know, they're trying to run high quality deworming programs. They're trying to improve them. They're definitely, you know, so then there's two points. I mean, one is that they are undertaking what I referred to earlier as policy oriented research around deworming. You can read more of the details of that in a blog post I recently wrote, but it, you know, it touches on questions like, should deworming focus on elimination of deworm of the infections, which would require more intense treatment than what is currently being done, which is treating children 1 to 2 times a year. And so to the extent that you are, you know, those, the research questions Deworm the World is trying to answer are compelling to you, I think they're a good bet to be achieving some of the goal that you have of improving the way that aid is delivered and finding new methods of doing so well. And there's certainly other questions that they're trying to answer than the one I just laid out. I mean, one example is giving out bed nets along with deworming pills. So, you know, they're working on some of these questions. But, you know, I think we primarily see Deworm the World as an organization that is, you know, scaling up the deworming programs. Evidence Action, which is their parent, is certainly involved in the activity. It's kind of sort of directly involved in the activity you're laying out, trying to run more programs that have strong evidence behind them. Right now, in addition to Deworm the World, they have another program called Dispensers for Safe Water. And, you know, that's another program that sort of directly came out of strong evidence and is now they're trying to scale up. AMF, which is, the organization that gives funds to malaria, I think the way in which they could potentially contribute to improved aid, so, most of what they do, I think, is money going to bed nets. I think there's some possibility that, let me take a step back. You know, AMF, the way in which they stand out is that they conduct a significant amount of intensive monitoring for their distributions. I think that the monitoring that is publicly available on AMF's website about their past distributions, showing things like a 6-month, 12-month after distribution check-in with the people who receive nets to determine what proportion are currently using nets, that is some of the, as far as I know, some of the best publicly available evidence about net use and net durability that exists, certainly for specific distributions that were conducted. And so I think it's possible that AMF has this impact on the malaria community more broadly by encouraging and advocating for and showing that it's possible to conduct this type of high quality monitoring after net distributions. That said, AMF remains a very small organization. It's essentially a 2-person operation. And, you know, there are some board members who also provide some time, but it's very small. And I think that limits the likelihood that AMF ultimately has this type of impact. Then there's the two iodization organizations. I think both of them are advocating for and trying to bring about better and higher quality salt iodization programs. And in some sense, that's part of their mission. But I think largely they are part of the, anyhow, I think that's the way in which they might be accomplishing what you want, though that's pretty baked into the, you know, what they're already undertaking. And then there's Development Media International and Living Goods. I mean, both of these are explicitly new ways of trying to save, you know, or I should say reduce child mortality in the developing world. And so to the extent that they are successful and that they scale up in the way that they eventually hope, they could certainly individually bring about the sort of goal that I think you have in mind. I think we know less about and we wrote this in our reviews, what their ongoing monitoring will look like and how much we'll be able to learn from them long term about the, you know, the success of their program beyond just the randomized control trial. So Daniel, I'm just going to unmute you quickly and see if that answered you or you had any follow-ups to it.
Yeah, that was great. My one follow-up just quickly with GiveDirectly is, do you have any sense whether donor money that goes through GiveWell next month will fund that RCT you were talking about, or do you know if that's already set in stone and funded? And
yeah, got it. I don't know for sure. Our understanding is that it's almost probably will be funded even without additional donations, because they roughly need to raise $15 million, and $15 million is kind of right around what we believe they'll take in exclusive of additional donations from GiveWell donors. So we don't think that, you know, a donation to GiveDirectly today directly influences the likelihood that this particular trial takes place. That said, I think there's some possibility, and a reasonably good one, that, you know, I think we should think about supporting GiveDirectly as supporting an institution that is interested in undertaking high quality research like this. I don't think there's like a direct one-to-one connection between like an extra $1 million means they will spend an extra X on experimentation. That's not a relationship we've sufficiently nailed down, but I think it certainly should be in your mind when thinking about GiveDirectly that they're actively interested in undertaking more high quality research and answering high, you know, research questions. All right, so I'm going to, Joey, I'm going to move to you because you had a question too. And you know, just want to remind others to, you know, feel free to, you know, type in or email in if they have questions. I'm happy to sort of answer anything, no matter how basic you think it is. I think the more discussion we can have and the less it can be just me talking, the better. So, hey, Joey, I just unmuted you. So you're on.
My question is on DMI. How would Gibwell update if they got back the results of the study and it was negative, seeing as it rests so heavily on the RCT that they're running?
Got it. So if they got the final results back and it found, like, you know, no real effect on mortality?
Exactly, something like that, or less than expected.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we would... I don't think we would continue to recommend them. I think it's like hard to make an argument that when, if you see an intervention that has been studied and it hasn't succeeded, it hasn't accomplished what it set out to. I don't see a good reason to continue recommending significant donations to them. I can imagine, and something we've talked about in the past at GiveWell is we also wouldn't want to create an incentive for charities to not share information. And so you'd want to think about the extent to which their getting a negative RCT result would really harm their long-term trajectory, because that could harm or deter other organizations from undertaking similar studies. And so I can imagine trying to get them some money that says, like, hey, let's let this organization, I don't know, get back on their feet or figure out what they're going to do next in response to their taking a risk and then finding out that their program wasn't working. One of the arguments we had this year around DMI internally was whether it made sense to recommend them at all this year, or whether we should just wait a year, or maybe it'll be 2 years before the end line results of their trial are out, because eventually we'll have end line mortality data, which will be significantly more robust than self-reported behavior change. And I think that is a reasonable position for a donor to take, you know, to say, I just want to wait and see the results. I'm not convinced enough right now by what's out there. We felt that, you know, when we sort of adjusted their impacts for all the uncertainty we have around a trial result, we felt that the, you know, the cost effectiveness, you know, still came out pretty competitively with the other organizations on our list. And so we felt like they, you know, they sort of belong there for now. Does that answer your question? Any follow-ups?
Yeah, just one thing. Would you update mid-year if you found out the evidence mid-year, or do you think you'd wait till the standard kind of yearly update before changing the recommendation on them?
Yeah, I mean, so the reason we've tried to stay to an annual update schedule is primarily just for, like, internal prioritization. If we were trying to keep our top charities page like perfect in real time, it would just like cause us to spend more time than I think we could really devote just to that goal. We end up spending, you know, the last 2 weeks before we release our recommendations, there's a lot of debate and conversation around exactly what we should recommend. And I think we can't always do that mid-year. That said, that is the main reason that we don't update more often. And so if there were something that was very concrete, that was easily updatable, we would be inclined to update it more quickly in the middle of the year. So I think DMI's trial results is a good example of that, where it, you know, would be relatively straightforward, though it still maybe takes some time to really go through and think about. The other example is something that we now intend to do about 4 months from now, which is updating our top charities list based on room for more funding considerations. You know, we think mm-hmm. that it's possible that as of April 1st, all of the many of the organizations will have hit their funding, the funding targets that we had for them. And at that point, we want to reassess our funding recommendations and have a list put out that is, you know, up to date for the remainder of the year. In the past, so this, to take you through a little bit of GiveWell history, in the past, almost all of the money that we moved was moved from December 1st to, you know, December 31st. And the amount of money we moved was relatively small. So in a year of like 2011, where I think we moved about $4.5 million, I think probably 3.5 of that came during December. And so there are also the stakes or the potential impact of having the optimized recommendations for the other 10 months of the year was much smaller because it, you know, you weren't talking about as much, you know, as much money. Now we expect, our best estimate is that from, you know, around April 1st to November 30th, we're going to move something like $3 to $4 million. And so the stakes involved and the potential impact that we have if we update our recommendations is much higher. And so we are going to adjust in that direction. I think that there, as we grow, there continues to be this argument that we might have to do more to try to keep our top charities page up to date throughout the year. And make sure that we're updating with information as it comes in. And so that's, you know, that's a challenge I think we'll have to face, you know, at some point, though perhaps not yet in 2015.
Perfect. That covers everything.
Okay, great. Okay, I'll mute you back. So we had another question come in from Kit. So Kit, I'll put you on in a sec, but I first just want to remind anyone, you know, if you have questions, please don't hesitate to ask. I'm really happy to answer sort of whatever, you know, questions you have about our top charities or others or kind of random things you've been wondering about GiveWell. You have to just kind of let me know that you have a question either over email or via the interface on the chat screen here. Kit, you should be all set. Why don't you shoot with your question?
Hi, I have a couple of quick questions. They're more about strategy. So do you think that corporate connections with your top charities is a high priority? And if so, how do you think that we can be doing that better?
Sorry, so you said our corporate, I'm not sure I understood the question. Are corporate connections important to charities?
One moment. I'll put it in the chat.
Okay. Got it. So the question is, are promoting corporate connections with your top charities a high priority? So what can you just elaborate on what you mean by that? And feel free to talk. I'll just turn up the volume of my phone. Do you mean for marketing reasons or for legitimacy reasons or what?
I think that there's a huge amount of funding available for charities. I work for a company which gives a lot to charity, but there's in many companies, there's a big opportunity to give to more effective charities. I wondered if moving money in that direction, so basically directing corporate charitable budgets, might be a really big opportunity both for you as an organization and also for your supporters who might be able to do more good by working with their own companies or companies they're aware of even more than their own donations.
Got it. Okay, I understand. Yeah, that's a really good question. I think you are right that there is a great deal of corporate giving. I think the challenge is convincing companies to give the funds they've allocated differently. You know, this is something that I remember being very excited about very early on in GiveWell's history. I think I personally called up like 25 or 50 companies trying to, you know, pitch them on using GiveWell's research. You know, you can probably imagine the response that I got, which was not very promising. Now, I was just, you know, an outsider. GiveWell was, you know, at that point, probably a year old. And so it's certainly possible that, you know, your experience would be different now. I think my instinct is that to do this well, it probably requires having a good connection with the people at your company who are making this decision, and being able to talk to them and understand why they're giving the way that they are. I think it's like not unlikely that it is pretty difficult and perhaps even impossible to change their minds. I think that one of the, you know, one of the experiences that we've had, I've had talking to, I guess, hundreds of donors over the years, is that there's a group of donors who are kind of already very excited about the attitude that GiveWell takes towards charitable giving. And just when you talk to them, they're kind of like totally on board from the start. And then there's a whole other set of donors. And then there's maybe some middle ground of people who can be convinced, who just need to ask a few questions and start out somewhat skeptical. But the vast majority of donors and people, and I think this would apply to corporate giving departments, are, you know, are just like not that excited and not that tuned into the type of analytical thinking about charitable giving that we do. And it sometimes seems like the communication gap is so large that it's just very hard to make any headway. So, I mean, those are kind of the somewhat pessimistic responses. I think my best advice, and maybe there's others on the call who have tried this too, and maybe they personally have advice. I mean, I think it is possible to potentially to have a more generic impact on the corporate giving of a company, either through promoting, you know, resources to employees, resources with GiveWell being one of them that can allow for more thoughtful giving. I think another possibility is encouraging a company to match donations to all charitable, you know, charitable organizations as opposed to a small subset that are on their list. Yes. You know, I think those are possibilities and are worth trying, certainly.
Okay, sure. May I ask another very quick question?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so if GiveWell was someday able to move a much larger amount of money, so currently the funding gaps are relatively small in terms of a small number of wealthy people could fund the funding gaps you've mentioned for your four top charities. How would your research process change to give people basically the opportunity to fund a wider total funding gap?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And I just muted you for a second because I was hearing some feedback, but I can put you back on to see if you have follow-ups. You know, I think we've really separated our research process now into two parts. There's our traditional work on top charities, and there's the Open Philanthropy Project. On top charities, I don't think we would do anything differently. I mean, I think this research process, the way it's working right now, is sort of following the criteria and approach that we want to be following. And we wouldn't change it just for the purpose of, you know, finding larger, being able to, you know, kind of have a larger potential funding gap. You know, that said, it remains, I think, a major goal for our top charities work. And right now, a moderate size problem that the funding gaps are not large. Now, we shouldn't understate the funding gaps. I mean, I think GiveDirectly could take in $20 million. If AMF goes through another couple rounds and moves the money out the door, they'll be in a position to take in $20 or $30 million. But you are right that right now, the amount of money that we are really excited about moving through these organizations is in the scheme of charitable giving as a whole and international aid very small. I think one of the major priorities that our top charities work has over the next few years is continuing to expand continue to add great organizations to the list and hopefully organizations that can take in significant amounts of money. And so we're trying to do that in a few different ways. One project that we're undertaking for new charities is to try to create or support the creation of new GiveWell top charities. So we've done a few things on that front. We've provided, I'm talking about us and Good Ventures is actually the foundation providing the funding, but Good Ventures provided funding to a group called New Incentives, which runs a conditional cash transfer program in Nigeria with the aim of incentivizing pregnant mothers who are HIV positive to take the HIV drugs that they need to prevent the mother-to-child transmission of HIV. So this is a program that's very promising. It's cash. It's potentially preventing AIDS infections. The organization is basically just a startup. We found them to be very transparent so far, but they don't yet meet the criteria of a GiveWell top charity. And so we're trying, you know, we haven't written very much about them. We're actually in the middle of working on our first write-up to just share, you know, what we've learned. But our hope is that 2 years from now, New Incentives is, you know, running its program well enough that it becomes a GiveWell top charity with the ability to take in significant amounts of money. You know, so that's one thing we're doing to try to expand the funding that our top charities can use. Another thing we've done is trying to help build the evidence base for programs that are, you know, that would meet our criteria of being a priority program. So that would mean, you know, funding or supporting research on, you know, research like randomized controlled trials of development programs for issues that have maybe only one trial that has a demonstrated effect, but you really want to see a replication or two before, you know, before being confident in giving that program more funding. And so we've provided some funding. Well, one other challenge related with that is you not only need the trial, but then you also need an organization that's excited to scale up the program. In the case of New Incentives, conditional cash transfers have a great deal of evidence behind them, and they were an organization that wanted to go and scale up, and so we're able to provide them funding. But on this other side of the equation, building the evidence base and identifying organizations for scale up, we've provided funding to Evidence Action, which is the parent organization of Deworm the World, and I talked about them a little bit earlier in reference to Daniel's question. And then also ID Insight, which is a group that you know, tries to conduct high quality monitoring of organizations' activities. With the hopes of identifying a program and an organization that can be monitored in a very high quality way and convincing to us as proven and promising, but then, you know, sort of scaled up by, and then an organization that can scale it up. So, you know, those are some of the things that we're doing to try to expand the list. The two other, I know I went on a little bit about that. So the two other quick things that are going on that I want to mention, or there's a few other possibilities that we've kicked around, and I don't know whether we'll be, how many of these we'll be doing in the future, but you should just be, I guess, aware of them. So one is obviously just continuing the sort of bread and butter of GiveWell's approach. And so that means continuing to investigate interventions that have evidence and organizations that implement those interventions. And so I think the ones that are most likely to be looked at next year are a couple more micronutrients, folic acid and iron, some immunization programs, specifically on immunization campaigns. So these are large-scale efforts to immunize, you know, virtually everyone that meets some characteristic in a population, like all women of childbearing age, against maternal transmission of tetanus to neonates. And so that would immunization campaigns for tetanus, meningitis, and measles. And then finally, there's a program, the Targeting the Ultra Poor program, which was an economic empowerment program that has been studied through, I think, 7 randomized controlled trials. And some of the papers are out, more papers are coming out, and there are organizations that implement this program. So we'll be looking at that next year. You know, another thing we've talked about, well, the other possibility, you know, I could imagine longer term is, you know, as the world continues to get better and as some of the opportunities that exist today, you know, they may go away, things like bed nets and deworming. And when I mean they may go away, I hope that eventually the aid community or the countries themselves have sufficient funds to cover their full population. And so at that point, I think other needs will move to the top of the list. And those could be more straightforward programs like providing better access to water, something that doesn't, you know, right now we haven't seen as strong evidence for the health impacts for, but as the, you know, as sort of the other opportunities diminish because the world gets better, it's possible that we will, you know, I can imagine ending up having organizations like that on our list, and certainly those, in addition to cash transfers, would be able to take in a great deal of funding. So, Kit, I hope that answers your question, and feel free to sort of chat back at me if you want to ask any follow-ups. So now I'm going to turn it over to Richard. I think you had a question that you said you wanted to ask.
Yeah, my sense is that the research date for the various charitable interventions, like bed nets, is fairly wretched. I of course come from a more pure science background, so I'm used to seeing, more solid research. But I was wondering if there would ever be a circumstance where instead of recommending giving to a charity, you'd recommend giving to, say, an RCT that would provide better evidence. And I'm thinking of it like a poorly studied intervention that has possibility for being really cost effective, but it also has the possibility for being completely worthless. And then it might be, instead of giving money to the charity, it might make more sense to give money to get evidence about the intervention. And so I was wondering if you'd ever recommend giving to studying charities instead of charities, and if you'd ever do that, under what circumstances?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a really good question. So let me, I think it's worth sort of talking first about what the quality of the evidence is for the various programs that we recommend. I think bed nets have the best evidence of the programs that we recommend. And I think it's reasonably strong evidence. So there roughly are, 20 plus randomized controlled trials, and you can read the details of this on our bed nets intervention page, but there's more than 20 randomized controlled trials that show that when you give out nets, they prevent malaria cases. Five of those trials measured mortality, and they show that, giving out bed nets saves lives. And so in our view, and then there's, we can go into the way in which but I think there's been reasonable evidence that the large-scale bed net distributions, you should expect them to have pretty similar results to the randomized controlled trials. Sort of happy to go more into that if anyone's interested, or Richard, if you are. I think bed nets have pretty strong evidence. I think on the flip side, you have something like deworming. And I think the evidence for deworming is far more mixed, far more complicated, and much less robust. And it's a case where, where bed nets is a case where I think the sort of error bands around our best guess are relatively small. With deworming, the error bands are incredibly large, because with deworming, we basically have, one randomized controlled trial of long-term effects, another more recent randomized controlled trial that was sort of a post-hoc reassessment of data that was available given that there was a randomized controlled trial. And this is the new study we wrote about in our blog this year. And then finally, a retrospective study in the American South of hookworm eradication. There are lots and lots of short-term trials of deworming programs, but, based just on those short-term results, we wouldn't be recommending deworming. Deworming is really an example of the type of program you're talking about that is kind of high, very strong expected value, but that comes from, a moderate probability of a very large impact, not a highly confident large impact. And so the question is, why not run a randomized controlled trial of deworming? With that background, that sort of gets into how we think about when it would make sense to contribute to the evidence base. With something like deworming, to add to the evidence base for deworming that we care about, meaning the long-term effects, it would require something like a 12-year investment of, millions of dollars in a randomized controlled trial and the follow-up. And I think there's a decent chance that 12 years from now, the funding gap for deworming is virtually non-existent. And so I think it's arguable that we already have enough information about deworming that we should spend the, globally, should spend the money to cover everyone and not try to perfect the information we have available about the intervention. I think it's more likely to be less actionable. On the other hand, there are programs where I think funding additional research make a lot of sense. So the example that, you know, I'm kind of personally excited about right now is there's a program that was studied in India, you know, I think about 10 years ago, where they provided incentives to mothers who were, they provided a bag of lentils to mothers when they brought their children to be immunized. And they found that by providing this incentive, this food incentive, they significantly increased immunization rates among the children. Now, this is a study that was like conducted at one place by one nonprofit in India like 10 years ago. And so this is not a program that I think has robust enough support for it to make sense to just like try to scale it up without additional evidence. But with additional evidence, this, you know, you could imagine this becoming an outstanding charitable giving opportunity. And so we'd be excited to provide support to a program like that. And it's actually something that we've talked a little bit about in that specific case. So let me pause there. Does that answer you? Do you have any follow-ups on that question?
So the sense I'm getting is that there are circumstances where marginal money going towards researching interventions would make sense, but because there's funding gaps elsewhere, giving money to the lentil program in India may not, it would just make more sense to give to, say, AMF.
To summarize what I think, it's that, you know, when deciding to give to support a trial, you need to just make more research. You need to make the assessment that the money you give will eventually cause more money to be spent more wisely, such that it's worth the cost of the trial. And I think in the case of deworming, you know, my guess is that an additional deworming trial won't be worth the money because it will take so long and cost so much, and deworming is so cheap that we should probably just do the deworming and get it over with. On the other hand, with the case of the, you know, this incentives for immunization program, I don't think we even know enough yet about the program. Like, I think it's at a level of the evidence base is at a significantly lower level than deworming, and therefore what's necessary there before giving is supporting additional research.
But it wouldn't make sense to give money to research it, though, until we had closed all the other funding gaps, because, you know, it would have to be just a complete anomaly in terms of cost effectiveness to give money there instead of giving to, say, you know, one of your established top charities, because we already have evidence there. Is that?
Yeah, so I'm not saying that. I mean, I think there's a reasonable argument to support this additional research. There's something of a, you know, intuitive argument that when there are promising approaches, it's worth spending relatively small amounts of money to know, to find additional outstanding approaches to aid, because that then, you know, then that approach can be scaled up by, you know, by ourselves, but perhaps even by other funders. And so when you have a relatively limited list of things that really work, there's a strong reason to try and create more of the things that do work. You know, there's also the fact, and this relates to what I think Kit raised earlier, are the funding gaps of our organizations right now are somewhat limited. And, so it's not the case that you can just, I mean, I wouldn't now recommend just giving AMF, you know, all the millions of dollars that could potentially be available. You know, I think that around $10 million is what they need for the time being. And when you have organizations with limited abilities to absorb and utilize funding, I think that's also a situation in which you want to support the creation of new giving opportunities.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. So I'm going to go to to Matt. Matt, I think you said you had a question. I don't know if it's the same one that you chatted or a different one, but why don't you you ask the question?
Yes. Hi. Thanks. I just posted it in the chat. It's basically, I'm assuming that there might be some geographic or cultural differences based on the cause. And I'm wondering if you know which causes are sort of highly dependent on location and which are sort of more generally robust, that are sort of more universal.
Yep, good question. So, let's see. I mean, I think that this question is one of the reasons that we've focused more on medical or health programs over time. I think I think it's probably right that albendazole, which is the treatment for some of the parasitic infections that comprise deworming, the worm infections, you know, albendazole is going to act on the infection and on humans, no matter where that takes place, whether it's in, you know, the U.S. or, you know, some part of Africa or somewhere else. And so, you know, I think medical programs are more likely to be more robust against cultural differences. It's also the case that with six of our eight organizations, so with AMF and BedNets, GiveDirectly and Cash Transfers, Deworm the World and SCI with deworming, and then the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition and ICCIDD with salt iodization, these are programs that no matter how culturally dependent they are, they have been implemented in many places over a long period of time. And so I think we have reasonable evidence that any of the impacts we found are not highly specific to one point in time or one geographic location. There's one exception to that. And the one exception to that of those six is deworming specifically. You know, I said in answer to Richard's question that much of the case for deworming relies on a single randomized controlled trial that took place in Western Kenya in 1998. And now we've added to that a second retrospective trial that was, you know, conducted in Uganda around the same time. The trial in Western Kenya in 1998 was subject to what appear to be relatively rare conditions for worm infections in the developing world in two ways. First, it just was a place of high intensity infection, which is very different than, you know, what appears to exist in most of the places that SCI and Deworm the World are currently working. And I'm going to put a link through in the chat right now, which just shows a comparison of some of the information we have from SCI, which is one of our deworming charities, a comparison of them to the studies that I'm referencing. So in one way, the deworming effects, let me add one more thing to it, which is that in the second year of the program, and this is now specific to the trial that took place in Western Kenya in 1998, it was an El Nino year, and that meant that there was significant flooding. And these worm infections are waterborne diseases. And so another factor to take into account, and we try to do this in our cost effectiveness analysis, is that the impacts that we see of a proportion of the population earning significantly more 10 years later, they were found in an area which had, I think, like extremely rare levels of these infections. And so there's a question about whether the effects are highly specific to the conditions present in that geographic location, or whether they're more generalizable. And so that, you know, I think with deworming, you know, we know that the drug kills the kids. The drugs kill the worms, not the kids. The drugs are pretty safe as far as we know. So we know that the drug acts the same way no matter where it is, but there is definitely a question with deworming about how representative the results we have are of the types of impacts you'd have long term. And it's these questions that lead to a lot of the variation among GiveWell staff in trying to judge the cost effectiveness of deworming. This is a good example of why we find, why I personally, and I think many staff find the cost effectiveness analysis we do to be somewhat, to be not as robust as we'd like. because we're putting a lot of these judgment calls in. And I think even among current staff members, judgment calls on just this one factor, you know, leaving out philosophical questions and many of the other factors that go into our cost effectiveness, I think it affects the cost effectiveness estimate by like a factor of 10 between staff. And so it's, you know, this certainly is, you know, something of an issue. Finally, the two organizations where I think this question is certainly very valid. I mean, it's valid regardless, but is perhaps most important is with DMI. So that's the one that that produces mass media broadcasts and living goods. You know, that's the one that has these micro entrepreneurs selling health goods door to door. I mean, I think it's intuitive that the success of radio messages would be highly culturally dependent. I mean, the organization hires locals to produce and write and act in the programs. But, you know, they may have been successful in Burkina Faso. It's unclear how successful they would be if they went to another country like Madagascar, Mozambique, or Cameroon, because they might just not be as successful at engaging with cultural norms in the way they were in Burkina Faso. There's also questions, and I don't remember if we talk about this in our review or not, but I think some countries have radio stations that are perceived as the mouthpiece of the government, as opposed to a more or less independent source of information. And so there may be places where people just don't even trust what they hear on the radio, or they implicitly distrust it. And that would certainly make DMI's job a lot harder, you know, in a country like that. Finally, you know, Living Goods also, it's a program that's been run at, you know, one place at one time. It seems to have worked pretty well in Uganda, but we don't really know how well it would work in other places. You know, a lot of what they're trying to do is scale up in Uganda itself. And so I think this question that you're asking of, you know, how externally valid is there external validity of these results? You know, would it apply to other locations? I mean, I think it's, you know, less of an issue for Living Goods if insofar as they're in Uganda and kind of nearby where they were before. As they move into other places, I think the question certainly would, you know, would be worth considering more closely. So Matt, did you have any follow-ups or any other questions, or did that help answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, that was really helpful. I mean, thanks for that. I recognize that in Living Goods case, that's especially true. One thing I saw was really interesting is the amount of money that people spend on cook stoves and just how significant the funding that is. I think it was 20% in Kenya and like 50% in Uganda, where it was flipped. The amount of money that they made was just selling those. And I know that those are highly dependent on location, because it matters a lot if other people are using improved cook stove or not to reduce the disease burden and stuff like that. So, and I was also sort of wondering if you've looked at anything in Southeast Asia or in Bangladesh, around Bangladesh, is there anything around there, or if it's been focused on sort of parts of Africa?
So most of the organizations that we are currently recommending primarily work in sub-Saharan Africa. But you know, we're open to any geographic location. And what I say, you know, it's not totally the case that they're only there. Deworm the World is trying to expand to Southeast Asia. I think they've been in conversations with Vietnam and maybe other Southeast Asian countries about implementing deworming programs. So they, you know, they may be there. And then the salt iodization organizations are pretty much working globally, looking for areas that have, you know, that don't have sufficient iodization of their salt. And so I think there are, you know, countries in sub-Saharan Africa are certainly important targets, because there are cases where they don't, you know, fully have that iodization going. But Eastern Europe, Russia in particular, but also other former Soviet republics, are ones that I think ICCIDD, one of the iodization organizations, would be trying to work on if it had additional resources to do so.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. I'm going to move over Joey. You said you had another question, and then I just want, you know, so Joey's the last question that's come in. If anyone is sort of waiting around to ask the basic question, you know, now's a good time. A couple of people have already dropped off the call, which is totally great. You can, you know, feel free to drop off at any time, but, you know, I'd really encourage you to, you know, use this opportunity to ask whatever's on your mind. If you're wondering it, I'm sure some other GiveWell or, you know, person who follows our research is thinking of it as well. And, you know, you can be helpful in putting it out there. But hey, Joey, why don't you ask your question?
Hey, so I just had a question regarding very big charities. So like Oxfam level charities. I know GiveWell hasn't reviewed them too much in the past because I know it's hard to interact with them. But now that GiveWell has a lot more staff and a lot more money, have you started to look at any very large charities as potentially promising or potentially worth reviewing?
Yeah, good question. So I think the way in which we're likely to, we have to some extent talked to some large charities. I think the most likely way that we, the most likely way that we end up recommending a large organization is by recommending funds to a specific program and restricting funds to that program. Our view hasn't really changed at all. I don't think an organization like Oxfam or Save the Children will ever be a good fit for a GiveWell unrestricted donation. I think that would take an enormous amount of work to feel, you know, highly confident about that type of donation. And my intuition is that, you know, those, given the breadth of the programs that they implement, they're unlikely to be competitive on cost effectiveness with our top charities. But you know, it's possible. But you know, so then so in terms of a specific program, you know, this obviously raises the question of fungibility. You know, meaning like if we give and restrict funds and we give them to Save the Children and say only use this for malaria, if Save the Children has significant unrestricted funding available, they might just, where it, before our those gifts, they would have given those unrestricted funding to malaria, and now they might give it somewhere else. And so we really are, we could really be supporting the organization as a whole rather than the program we want. And so that's this problem of fungibility. So I think the most likely thing we, the most likely way in which we'll try to overcome this is by thinking harder about whether there are cases where fungibility is not really a concern and finding organizations implementing proven programs where they can convince us that the funds are not fungible. So, you know, a starting point of that is our recommendation of Deworm the World. It's one of two programs run by Evidence Action. We are confident that donations are primarily going to Deworm the World. They're not, you know, supporting just Evidence Action as a whole. Similarly, we are now recommending the Global Alliance for Nutrition, GAIN, you know, GAIN's universal salt iodization program. GAIN is a larger organization. They run, you know, many nutrition programs that are not iodization. And we recommended salt iodization specifically because our understanding is that GAIN has little unrestricted funding. And, you know, they were primarily created through a grant from the Gates Foundation years ago. And so we expect these funds to, you know, be allow to support salt iodization, and the counterfactual is less money for salt, not less money for GAIN overall. We also have talked to UNICEF a few times over the past few years. The program that we looked most closely at this year is their maternal and neonatal tetanus immunization program. And I think, you know, right now the work we're doing is an intervention report assessing the evidence of effectiveness and cost effectiveness of UNICEF's maternal and neonatal tetanus program, or I should say the sort of the immunization campaigns themselves, which we would apply to UNICEF's program. And we're still in the midst of that work, and we're not entirely sure how it will turn out. So I think the bottom line is that there will be more investigation of larger scale charities in the future. I think they still remain, you know, they remain one of the ways in which we may be able to find more ways to direct funds to proven programs. But they have these challenges associated with them in terms of fungibility, also in terms of communication. You know, our experience in dealing with our top charities is that, you know, more or less, they are small enough that we're able to talk to an individual who pretty much knows everything that's going on at the organization and can answer our questions. And when you start talking to larger organizations, they have a communications infrastructure in place to interface with outside donors. And that the existence of that communications infrastructure has made it more difficult for us to answer questions as directly as we would like. But again, I think that will be something that I certainly hope we can overcome in the next couple of years. Does that answer your question or any other related questions or follow-ups?
Yeah, that answers that question. I have some unrelated questions if no one else has any questions they're going to type up.
I have one other question. Person who has a question, so I'll go to him and then I'll come back to you afterwards.
Sounds good.
All right, so Stephen, you said you had a question, so what's on your mind?
Hi. Can you give your current thoughts on how potential donors should choose whether to give to GiveWell or give to the top charities?
Sure. Good question. So we haven't done a budget update in a couple of months. When we do, we'll post a blog post about it. But the big picture sort of remains the case that GiveWell is a nonprofit. We need to raise money. Because we've grown, we continue to have funding needs from donors, and so we're fundraising. And to some extent, decision comes down to like a donor's preference. But my personal view is that one of the best things a donor can do is support GiveWell itself, because that enables us to, to do our work and prevents us from having to spend an inordinate amount of time on fundraising. That said, I think it's also the case that, if GiveWell ever were in like a lot of trouble, the worst thing we would have to do is like reduce staff to some extent, really go on a big fundraising tour, try to raise more money from our larger donors. I mean, these are all like very bad outcomes that we don't want to have to bear. But I think for, some donors that, they might be open to that, happening with GiveWell. And so I think if you're someone who, sort of thinks GiveWell is great and you sort of fully trust us and want to put us in a position to just like do our work and maximize what we can do and not have to think about fundraising, a gift to GiveWell is a great idea. And if you know us less well and, you're less certain that you should be supporting our existence and our safety relative to our top charities, I think giving to our top charities is is also like a really great thing to do. So Stephen, I know I'm not sort of giving you like a, I know I'm not giving like a very, maybe the sort of bottom line answer that you're looking for. I think it is still the case that what, we put in a blog post last year is like basically the situation, which is that, Holden, and I, so Holden, is my co-founder at GiveWell, our opinion is that if you have a high degree of trust and alignment with us and you want to make the highest impact gift possible, Holden and I think that, giving us and like telling us that you'll give to us predictably is the best thing you can do. On the other hand, you to the extent that like people have slightly less trust or are, less fully aligned with GiveWell, I think that giving to our, top charities is like a great thing to do, and not only supports them, but frankly supports us too, because it demonstrated, sort of the impact of our research. And the reason I said Holden and I specifically, as opposed to like the GiveWell staff recommendation, is there are definitely some people on GiveWell staff who think that, who think like, hey, maybe we should, really try to just raise more money from larger funders and not ask for more money from the general public. They think spending a little more time on fundraising or raising more money from those larger donors is a reasonable thing to do. And therefore, we wouldn't, the recommendation to give to GiveWell is not, the necessarily the best one.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. All right. So, Richard, I'm going to come back to you for your question.
All right. For something completely different. Last year I pitched effective charity to the church I attend, and did a fairly mediocre job of it. Are there any resources to help people who are, you know, who see this effect of charity? It's like, I've always had these intuitions about it, and, you know, I'm one of the people who, you know, just heard about it and got right on board. Is there any resources to help us pitch to people who are a naive audience?
Sure. So I think the best resource that I know of, though it depends on how long people want to spend. I mean, I send people to Peter Singer's book. So Peter Singer is this philosopher at Princeton who gave a TED talk about effective altruism, which is a movement that GiveWell is, you know, kind of considered to be a part of. And so I think Peter Singer's book, The Life You Can Save, if someone is ready for a full book length description of this, is a great introduction to the ideas of, effective giving and the case for effective giving. And then I think his TED talk is another good, sort of another good resource if people want the sort of 15-minute video introduction. And then more generally, you know, depending on what exactly you're looking for, I think there are a lot of resources from the effective altruism community as a whole. And I think just, via Googling, you would find resources and individuals who, might be helpful. There's also I don't know like how active it is right now, but there's a Facebook group for effective altruists. And I've sometimes seen people posting questions like this. Like, here's my presentation I'm planning to make to my, to my church group or to my friend group. Do you have advice of what I could use to make it better? So those might be some things to check out to start if you haven't already.
All right. Thanks.
Sure. Joey, let me go back to you and see if you have any other, what your other questions was.
I was just wondering if you could elaborate a bit on the difference between ICC IDD and GAIN. I don't actually have a very clear distinction between what they do in terms of how they differ.
Yep, good question. So ICC IDD is a very small, largely volunteer-run network of academics. And so the people who are associated with ICC IDD are like university professors who focus on salt iodization. And the sort of the person coordinating them is one of the leading researchers on salt iodization. His name is Michael Zimmerman. His papers are the ones that we relied on, or some of them in our intervention report. And then there's a network of people around the world, each of whom is responsible for a region. And so the regional coordinator, as they're known, will get a $25,000 to $30,000 stipend to basically spend time in many countries in the region trying to improve their salt iodization programs. And this can mean anything from, having meetings with government ministers to, encourage them to implement legislation or tell them what's going wrong, to reviewing materials that the government has produced and telling them how they can be improved. But it's all at a very, 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 extremely light touch, low intensity level, because it's people who are spending probably like 10 hours a week and a $25,000 a year stipend traveling around, 10 hours a week on average, traveling around trying to influence policy. One of our staff members, Tim Talene Lawton, led this investigation. He talked to five of the regional coordinators, and I think we've published notes from a number of them. I don't know whether we published those conversation notes from all of them, trying to really understand what they did and how it might have influenced policy. And we weren't able after those conversations to be confident that they had an impact. And so I think that those, the question of whether they've actually had an impact certainly remains, though, I think it's plausible, certainly plausible that they do. And if they do, it's quite cost effective. So that's ICC IDD, sort of network of volunteer academics, $400,000, $500,000 a year budget, doing this type of work. GAIN is a more established, larger scale organization. And salt iodization is, a program where they are more involved in the sort of day-to-day operations of Salt Itization and getting it off the ground. What they do varies a lot by the country in which they're working. So I think in, you know, in the Philippines, I think they had someone who was, you know, really going, or they were like advising, I don't remember if it was a GAIN employee or not. So they in some way supported, either through advising or funding, someone to be going, you know, factory to factory testing salt samples to make sure that the ionization was high quality enough. And I think in India, a lot of what they did was implementing an improved monitoring system. And, you know, in Ethiopia, I think they were involved in the negotiations to have Ethiopia, you know, take on, to start iodizing its own salt. So I know that, you know, all of that is somewhat vague. And frankly, this is one of the, you know, one of the, we think that, you know, our understanding of GAIN, if you look at the review on our website, is explicitly less, you know, lower quality, sorry, our understanding, not their activities, our understanding of what they do is, you know, has lower resolution than it does for other organizations. And that's something that we hope to, you know, improve in the future. So the way I would sort of summarize all of that is that ICCIDD is very small, volunteer-driven academics who are, you know, most of what they do is like one-on-one conversations with people or like reviewing some documents. GAIN is more, you know, more intense, more people, and they're more highly involved in the rollout and operations of the salt programs. But in both cases, I don't, you know, it's not as easy as I wish it were to really explain to you the specifics of what they do.
Perfect. Thanks.
So Joey, if you have more questions, I'm happy to sort of you to run through them, or if that's it, that's also fine.
Yeah. So I have some questions on AMF.
Yeah,
I know they had room for funding, and I think you mentioned on your website that you were going to give kind of like a 2-year cycle for them to distribute the bed nets.
Yeah.
When would you expect, say, a dollar donated now to actually end up getting distributed, given the kind of longer time frame that you have for them?
I think it's like really, really hard to say. I think it's possible. You know, so the way what makes AMF very challenging on this question is that they could literally reach an agreement for all the money they have in the bank and reach it, you know, 3 months from now. And I guess you could imagine that going to a bed net distribution that takes place 6 to 12 months later. So it's, you know, there's no reason that it's like highly unlikely that a dollar goes in tomorrow and is like in the field in a year. And that's for all of it. You know, so our room from our funding estimate could definitely be undershooting if AMF has an easy time reaching an agreement on a large distribution. On the other hand, you know, we have seen the challenges that AMF has faced since December 2011 to reach agreements with countries. And so it also, I mean, I think they've improved. There's empirical evidence that they've done so because they've reached more agreements. But it certainly could be the case that they sit on the money for 3 more years. You know, that wouldn't be shocking. And so I don't even think I could offer you a best guess as much as to say I think both of the options, both of the outcomes of, you know, money out the door, the money you donate tomorrow out the door in a year, and money you donate tomorrow sits for a few years are like not totally unlikely. I guess my like totally... you know, my total guess that is not like based in very much, I guess my guess would be based in like how much money they moved last year and like kind of like maintaining that level of, you know, that level of that pace of agreeing to distributions would put them around, you know, $10 million this year and, you know, maybe growth in the following year. So that means that given that they have about $7 million in the bank right now, you know, I think that the, you know, well, 7 plus 5 from Good Ventures, the $12 million they have, my best guess is that it sort of like covers them for a little while. And the funds donated after that will be like moving out the door in 2016 or something. And again, this is all just very rough. The thing that is confusing And sorry that this answer is a little confusing. I'm sort of thinking it through as I go. But, you know, the thing that's difficult about AMF is that, you know, if by September they've reached $10 million worth of agreements, they need to have more money in the bank to continue doing their work, or at least an expectation of having money in the bank, and a highly confident one, because AMF can't go to countries and offer to provide bed nets unless they know they'll have the funding to provide. And so therefore, they kind of need to have a cushion beyond the money they commit immediately so that they're able to go out and make deals and do so legitimately.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. I know the estimate's going to be super fuzzy on that. I just wanted to get your best sense, essentially.
Cool. So, Joey, did you have any other questions on AMF or other topics? I'm happy to sort of run through them.
Yeah, so on AMF as well, I think Gibble's best estimate was $5 a net, but AMF says on their website it's $3 a net. I was wondering if there was a particular reason for that discrepancy.
Yeah, so there actually is, and I think it's just the different ways we talk about the costs of nets. So what we like to do in our cost estimates is include all the costs associated with a program, not just the literal cost of buying a net. So I believe, and I'm not like looking at the AMF website right now, but I believe that nets, AMF pays around or like slightly less than $3 to purchase a net. But then in order to get the net to like run the program in the way AMF wants, there are other non-net costs such as shipping, distribution costs, monitoring costs. And so the numbers that are on our page at the link I'll put through in the chat right now, which is the cost per LLIN distributed, LLIN being long-lasting insecticide-treated net. You know, that those costs include everything that goes into the program, including like government-provided costs or NGO-provided costs, such as like trucks and fuel for distribution and follow-up monitoring. And our view is that, you know, when donors want to support a program like AMS, they should be excited or ready to support all of the costs associated with that program, not just the commodity cost of the net, because I think otherwise you get into this weird case of donors trying to leverage each other by refusing to pay some costs and hoping that others pay others. And instead, we prefer to look at the cost of AMS program as all of the costs collectively that are required for their program to run as they hope. Finally, we do project different costs for the different countries in which AMF is working. So we think the costs in Malawi are significantly cheaper than the costs in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC. I am not 100% sure about why there is the $2 difference to $2.20 difference. My understanding is that the DRC is a more difficult place to work. I think the people may be more spread out, such that the distribution costs are higher, but I may be getting the exact cause of the difference in Malawi versus DRC costs. I may be off on that.
Great, that's really helpful. I think it put a question in the chat.
Yeah. Kit, did you want to ask your question?
Yeah. I saw you made a note about giving now versus giving later in your updated Top Charities blog post. Basically, I plan on giving now to some extent, partly from an advocacy basis. But in terms of what I give in the long term, I'm considering giving later. And I'm basically wondering what you think the key factors are in thinking about that kind of thing currently, especially given your recent update about how perhaps it's a comparison between your traditional top charities work and the more speculative or high-risk work like things like GiveWell Labs. So basically kind of key factors in give now versus give later.
Yeah, totally. That's a really good question. I think the key factors are the following. The first one is how much better will future giving opportunities be relative to current opportunities? And you know, we have a post from a few years ago called Give Now versus Give Later. I'll send that through in the chat. I mean, that post makes the general argument that other things equal, You know, we think it's better to, you know, to give sooner. But, you know, I think with that in mind, if you think the giving opportunities in the future will be significantly better, then you, if they are better enough, it may be worth saving. You know, within that, our belief now is that the opportunities available through our traditional work focused on internationally focused top charities, we're unlikely to find significantly better opportunities there such that it would be worth waiting. You know, so for donors who think that they're going to support that type of activity, we would recommend giving now. Further supported by the fact that I think those opportunities may even get worse over time. You know, as you know, generally, I think the world is getting better, and opportunities like deworming and nets, I certainly hope, are no longer giving opportunities 10 years from now. You know, I really hope that, you know, we collectively have fully covered those problems. So then there's the question for donors, and you're asking this about, you know, what we're GiveWell Labs, what we used to call it. Now we're calling that the Open Philanthropy Project. So with these Open Philanthropy Project ideas, I think that they may be significantly better than our top charities work. I think in terms of impact per dollar, I think the jury is definitely still out on that. A lot of what motivates us to undertake this work is to try to have a better view about how specific opportunities compare between sort of high risk, high reward opportunities relative to our top charities. But certainly those opportunities could be a lot better. And I think we will know a great deal more within the next 2 or 3 years. You know, where our top charities work, I think, is now progressing and improving on something of moving linearly upwards, where we're just getting like slightly better every year. I think our open philanthropy work has a different shape to the curve, where we know so little that we're going to know much, much more in the next 2 or 3 years. And so I think that's definitely like a reasonable thing to be thinking about when deciding about where to give and whether to give now or later. You know, the only other thing that I think you really that kind of all relates to that first question. Will the giving opportunities available in the future be better than the ones that are now? But then there's this other side of the issue, which is, you know, how much funding will be available in the future relative to the funding available, will be available to those opportunities, and how good will the marginal opportunity be? And I think that is a much harder question to answer, but also that also pushes me in the direction of giving sooner. Because I think that the whole enterprise of, you know, the work that we are doing, all the work that's going on in the effective altruism community more broadly, I really think that this idea is at a very, you know, it's this like idea of giving effectively, and it's at a very early stage. And as this idea spreads, I believe, I'm optimistic that significantly more funding will come in to the field. And so, you know, right now, Good Ventures, this foundation we work very closely with, they're the largest funder that is actively supporting the type of, you know, the research that we do, the opportunities that we find. But I think it's, you know, reasonably likely that other large funders like them, you know, funders that probably don't exist yet, but the future large philanthropists, you know, many of them want to behave similarly. And, you know, if that happens, which I really hope it does, that will mean that there'll be significant funding available to the types of opportunities we find. And so I think that is, you know, that is also something that, you know, pushes me to want to give sooner, because I'm more confident that the money available today is smaller than the amount of funding that will be available in the future. You know, there's certainly other reasons to consider giving later rather than giving now. In particular, if you think, you know, you might have unique information about some opportunity that others might not have, and it, you know, could come up in the next year or two. I mean, I think there's always those types of unique circumstances. You know, we're certainly very grateful to the donors who gave us our startup funding back in 2007. And we, you know, we were happy they were able to do so. And I think if, you know, but they knew us well, they were close to us, and so they were able to be in a position to make that judgment well. There's always those types of opportunities which, you know, might not be on the radar of, you know, a group like us. And you know, if you think, I think some members of GiveWell staff, you know, last year, you know, we wrote this blog post where they said where they were giving, and some of them decided to wait. And I think some of them had like specific opportunities in mind where they felt like they could arise in the next year, and they wanted to be in a position to be able to support them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Great. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. So I don't know if there's any other questions. I don't have any other questions in the queue. I'm really happy to sort of stick around and answer any of the things that are on people's minds. Also, I know it's been a while. So if people are questioned out or don't have any other things on their mind, you know, we also can wrap up. But let me just give it, you know, 30 seconds. And I really encourage you to, you know, let me know if you have any questions, even if they, you know, they're really basic. There aren't too many people on the call right now, so you don't have to be shy about asking basic questions if they're the ones that you're interested in. It's also, frankly, helpful to us to have these calls to know what are on the minds of people who follow us and what are the questions that we haven't sufficiently answered. So really don't hesitate at all to jump in with basic questions. I'd be happy to stick around and answer them. All right. Looks like my good. See, I knew that my encouragement would succeed. All right, Richard, why don't you shoot with your question?
I noticed that after your recent charity recommendations came out for quite some time, the Wikipedia page for Against Malaria Foundation hadn't been updated. Are you guys allowed? Are GiveWell employees allowed to edit the Wikipedia page? Because that would seem like something you'd want to do immediately after the recommendations, because at least 20 people are, based on the Wikipedia page stats, are visiting that each day and not having the 2014 update probably affected some of their choices.
Yeah, I mean, our approach has been to not edit Wikipedia for ourselves, the Wikipedia page for GiveWell itself, or for the organizations we recommend. I think it's the fact that inaccurate information was there for a while is true. I think that the on balance, like it's pretty important to us to sort of I don't want to be like close to the line of doing something with Wikipedia that we shouldn't. And I think that one could easily make an argument that promoting Against Malaria Foundation on Wikipedia is like in our, I actually don't know all the Wikipedia guidelines, but it seems like close to the line of what wouldn't be consistent with what Wikipedia wants. And so we've generally stayed away from that and have, waited for others to make those changes themselves. And it looks like, now on the Wikipedia page, someone has made that change. So it's certainly a little bit late, but, not terribly so.
Okay. Thank you.
Richard, I don't know. I'm just curious. I don't know how familiar you are with Wikipedia guidelines. If you're not familiar at all, that's fine. But if you are, I mean, do you think that what I'm saying is correct? If you are, and if you're not, just let me know. But if you are, do you think that we should be updating the Wikipedia page, or do you think it is kind of like close to the line of what would be violating Wikipedia's guidelines?
I mean, if you check the update, mostly it's just quoting your review verbatim. I'm not familiar with the guidelines, but I think the basic conflict of interest objection is, if the update's going to be quoting your review, then I think that probably a good way is to find somebody in the community, in the effective altruist community, who doesn't work for GiveWell and ask them to make sure things are up to date or maybe something. I don't know quite enough to actually edit Wikipedia.
Right. Okay. Well, that's helpful. Yeah, I mean, the experience that we've had is that we see people who, tend to update these pages relatively quickly. And so we're happy to have them do that and just generally to, you know, sort of stay out of it, which I think is probably the right thing to do, especially when it seems like the problem is relatively small in that, you know, Against Malaria was updated, looks like a few days after our recommendations went live. All right, so let's go back to Kit. Kit, I think you had a question.
No, I was just adding a smiley face as I made that edit. It's very simple. I got an account for the first time yesterday and made the first edit, and it's quite easy, so I definitely recommend people do it. I would have updated the others, but I'm a bit short on time at the moment.
Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, we appreciate it. I don't think it's the... we definitely appreciate when people who are not associated with GiveWell but just follow us, you know, keep the sort of public materials up to date. And we do see some traffic coming to our website from Wikipedia, so we're happy when it's sort of fully up to date. All right, Joey, you said another question, so I'll come back to you now. And, you know, just a reminder to anyone else, if you have a question, just let me know and you can get in the queue and ask. So, Joey, why don't you shoot with your question?
Yeah, so I wanted to ask about essentially how to value different types of studies. So some of the studies that you guys have, like the DMI one, and I know GiveDirectly, are studies directly on the charity doing their intervention. So they have really good validity, essentially. How do you compare that to, say, a field which might be more evidence-based, but with less direct evidence? So, I mean, DMI versus iodization might be like a really good comparison of different types of evidence.
Yeah. It's a really good question, and I think there's another one we could add into the mix, which I'll put out there, which is, GiveDirectly, which is cash, and the deworming ones also create their own challenges. The way that, you know, we try to do this is by thinking of the factors that, you know, matter most, and then both debating them qualitatively, but also including them quantitatively in our cost effectiveness estimates. So with a group like, let's say, Living Goods, they have an RCT of their program finding strong results. So there's a couple issues. The first issue is, you know, there's this question of how likely do you believe it to be that the RCT result is like, quote unquote, real? And by that, I don't just mean that it's a statistically significant effect and not random chance. But there's this, you know, kind of... there's this general question about whether RCT results are likely to be replicable or not. And I think that any single RCT, there's some chance that, and I think a significant one, that the results found would not be replicated in a second trial. And if that's the case, the effect is would not be appropriate to call it, quote unquote, a like real effect, because you wouldn't expect it to happen again in the future. Now, why you would get a false RCT result is something that, I think there's a lot of different reasons. Certainly, I think the most likely, kind of a very likely one, is that, researchers have strong incentives when they're running trials to find positive results, and that may lead them consciously or subconsciously to do things that make the results of their trials more likely to come out positive, you know, even if they don't really recognize that's what they're doing. That can happen when they run the trial. That can happen when they evaluate the data. But I think there's reasons to be at least cautious about interpreting the result of a single randomized controlled trial too strongly. And so that's why in our cost effectiveness sheets, we have this thing called the replicability adjustment, where most of the time, if all you have is a single trial, you know, we're only going to count that as a 50% likelihood or so, and it varies by staff member, that result would occur again if the trial were run again. And the person who's done the most, I think is most famous for doing work on this question of replicability is a researcher at Stanford named John Ioannidis. It's his research that we link to from our cost effectiveness spreadsheet. And then there's this question, and it relates to a question Matt asked earlier about external validity. You know, even if you have a single trial, how likely is, you know, that to apply to other locations and other times? And so we sort of similarly try to adjust for that in our cost effectiveness and in how we think about the quality, the likelihood the program will work, and the quality of the, the likelihood that it will go well. So anyhow, I mean, these are the sort of the main two questions we're thinking about, the replicability adjustment and the external validity. And then how exactly you apply it is like quite difficult. With something like salt iodization, there's, I think, very strong evidence from multiple trials that when people receive salt, it improves their cognitive development. There is, I think, like no demonstrable track record, no identifiable impact that ICCIDD or GAIN has had as an organization. And so it can be very tough to like, you don't have the same level of confidence that the organization has done it as you do in the intervention. And the SALT intervention itself is just to be clear, is a lot more complicated and nuanced than I just laid out. So you should probably read the page to get all the details. You know, then you have an organization like Living Goods. So that's a program where it's one trial of the organization, but I think there's major questions about replicability. There's some questions about cost effectiveness. And then if they were to go to other places, questions about external validity. You know, we've already touched on DMI and how external validity comes up there, and the deworming organizations where there's many, many trials, but very few focused on the long term. You know, none that are measuring the organizations themselves, and some questions about how representative the trial conditions are of the current conditions. And then finally, well, not finally, we could talk about all of them in this way, but there's GiveDirectly, where cash transfers are like probably the single most studied development organization at this point and most studied in randomized controlled trials. But on the other hand, virtually all of those programs were very small cash transfers, you know, something on the order of like a small percentage of income that comes through monthly, where GiveDirectly is giving what they refer to as an asset transfer, you know, basically providing people with a significant increase in their income as a one-time gift. And that's something that really has not been studied in the cash transfer literature as a whole. But GiveDirectly itself does have this single RCT of its program. And so I think these are the, I don't know. I mean, I think all these are the types of questions that, you know, you have to think through and weigh when trying to distinguish one organization from another. And, you know, I think that like people's intuitions will vary about how relevant these different considerations are. And I think that we, you know, generally have limited enough empirical evidence about what really does matter, that it does kind of come down to one's judgment and intuitions rather than an answer that can be, you know, demonstrated based on the, you know, that can be demonstrated solely based on the, you know, the empirical track record of the various types of programs.
Yeah, great. That's really helpful. I know it's a super complex issue.
Great. Yeah, I mean, I think what's in the blog post is that where we announce our top charities is trying to lay out a lot of these main considerations. But it's frankly challenging to weigh them all appropriately and come to the right conclusion. All right. Well, any other? All right. Here we go. Let's see. So Matt, I'll let you ask that question if you're willing to jump in.
Sure. Yeah. So I have another friend here, Landry, and he was actually interested. He's originally from Burundi, and so he was really interested in this question of what the drugs that the deworming initiatives are actually using. Which ones are they using? Because I think he thought that there was a big difference in cost and potentially side effects of the drugs used.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't believe there are differences in basically there's one drug, albendazole, that is primarily for a set of deworming infections known as soil transmitted helminths. And then there's a drug called praziquantel, which is primarily for the deworming condition known as schistosomiasis. I'm reasonably sure that those are the drugs that are given out everywhere. Neither of them has terribly large side effects, but some of them do have some like short-term effects, like, you know, nausea, an upset stomach, fever. That can happen. They do have difference in I think there is a pretty big difference in cost. or there can be, because albendazole, I think, is primarily donated by the drug manufacturers, or like basically the full need is donated. And praziquantel still, while it's often donated now and has the drug companies have been increasing donations over the past few years, in some cases, they still have to be bought. But I mean, in both cases, they're cheap. I mean, they're like, you get the pill between like twice a year, like a couple pills, like a single dose, like twice a year, or like once every few years, depending on the intensity of the infection in the area that is being served. And they're quite cheap. I mean, I think between, you know, on the order of like 5 to 30 cents per pill. If you want more detail on all of this, the link I'm sending through here goes to the side effects part of our deworming report, where we sort of go through what's known about possible negative or offsetting impacts. And then we also go through, for one of the organizations, sort of a very careful estimation for SCI of how much each treatment costs and what proportion of that is like drug costs versus other things. And so that second link goes to the section of our review where we go through that. And you can click through to this this kind of spreadsheet where we go through all the details. I guess I'll just I'll send that through too, because that's like the sort of the main source to go to.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep, sure. All right. Any other questions? Even if it's just like, hey, did GiveWell look into this? Where is that on our site? If so, I'm happy to answer them. But you know, I know we've also been on the phone a while. If anyone, so there's no need to jump in. But let me. All right. I'll just going to keep encouraging people to ask questions, and we can just spend all day chatting about top charities. That'd be pretty fun. So Joey, go with your question.
Yeah, that would be fun. Although this is my last one. I was wondering if you could just lay out like any broad kind of epistemology or ways of weighing evidence that GiveWell does differently from other people in the field. So maybe compared to like Innovation for Poverty or something, what kind of broad differences do they have? Are they more skeptical or something like that?
Okay. Yeah, definitely. So I think I don't feel confident enough about what other people believe to speak to them, but I think I can lay out some of the value. I mean, so there's like sort of the value judgments or intuitions that drive our work, and I think are like definitely debatable. And if you know you find yourself thinking otherwise, you should consider that. So I think like one of the most obvious ways in which we are different than people might be about this type of program, and this relates to a question. I think the first question I read out on this call is, you know, isn't it the case that cost effectiveness analysis is everything, and that therefore what we should do, like, I think this is a position one could take, like, shouldn't we just build a model that estimates impact per dollar for each organization and then rank the organizations based on that model? And, you know, our view, and we've written a lot about this, and if you don't know where to find the links, just email me afterwards and I can sort of send through various links that are relevant to this question. You know, our view is that cost effectiveness analysis is important, but can only take us so far because of the limitations inherent in the modeling that, you know, we and others do. And so that is definitely a position that GiveWell takes that, you know, someone else might not. And I think if you are someone who takes cost effectiveness analysis, you know, wants to put all your weight on cost effectiveness analysis and have that be the sort of the single driving factor of your decision, you know, then giving to an organization like Deworm the World or possibly Standouts, the Itization or Development Media International, you know, those become the right judgment call. Another way in which I think we stand out is that, you know, we do tend to be on the skeptical side of the spectrum of academic research. So if someone says like, lots of papers show X, or the global health community accepts Y, you know, we want to like understand where that consensus comes from. We want to understand the methodology and the weakness, strengths and weaknesses of the papers that go into that conclusion. And we don't just take it at face value. And so, you know, I think we tend towards the skeptical side of the spectrum on accepting research results. That sort of skepticism is a lot of what drives the intervention reports that we do, where, you know, we really want to understand, even if there's this clear consensus that solidization is good, we want to understand exactly where that comes from and how strong a claim that is relative to other developmental programs. And I definitely think there are communities that would be more, would interpret the evidence more generously and not need to evaluate it for themselves. Another place that I think probably the third and maybe final place where where we might differ is that we care a lot about knowing how things turned out. So when I look at an organization like AMF and GiveDirectly, those two organizations, one of the things I think is really praiseworthy about them and leads me to be more confident in giving there is that they're conducting monitoring that means that a year from now, I'll know what happened and how well the program worked. And I think some people might say, these programs, giving out bed nets, deworming pills, cash transfers, they've been conducted for so long by so many groups that you shouldn't be skeptical that they'll be conducted well. And instead, you should just give to groups that implement proven programs, regardless of the monitoring information they have or the information they make available to GiveWell. You should just basically trust that the process will work well. That's not our attitude. I mean, I think that, in my personal experience, I've seen enough that goes wrong, that's difficult to accomplish, I don't personally just trust that an organization that is credible and respected would necessarily do things well. I think you can do things poorly, even if you have good intentions. And so that leads us to, want to recommend organizations that we have thoroughly vetted and have shared information with us, and we've seen that they have a track record. I think that is a very debatable position to take. And I wouldn't be, I don't think it would be unreasonable for someone to say that they, for someone to disagree with that judgment call and therefore be more lenient in the amount of information they would expect from an organization before recommending it or giving to it.
Great. That's really helpful. And of course, I agree with all of this. I had way too much experience with the expected value calculations turning out to be completely misleading and unfounded.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's even more than that. I mean, even it's basic operational factors. I mean, it's just challenging to get things to work, and so I tend to, and I think many people can struggle to do things, well. Even something as simple, we've written about this. It's very difficult to hire and manage staff, and organizations that want to scale have to do that. And when you give to an organization, you're essentially a trusting that they're able to do that well, to manage and hire their staff. And so, we want to see some evidence that it works. Again, I think it's debatable. You brought up some of the research organizations specifically. I think the biggest way in which we differ from them is perhaps just in terms of our goal. And so I'm not sure that the apparent differences in how we talk about research are really represent fundamental differences in beliefs. We write more skeptically about the cost effectiveness and the impact of a program than Innovations for Poverty Action or the Poverty Action Lab does on their websites. But, they are academics running research programs trying to make policy-oriented, policy-relevant recommendations. And, we're trying to be a sort of intensely transparent guide to donors. And I don't know. I think if you sort of had them in a room with us, I think it's quite plausible that we would end up agreeing on a lot of the things that I've said, and so some of the apparent differences may not be there. That said, the differences may be there. I'm just not sure that they are. All right. Well, let's see. If anyone, I'm just gonna kind of do my pitch again for some more last question. So we have one more from Richard. So I'm gonna turn it back over to Richard.
I found Holden's talk at the Effective Altruism Summit in 2013, which is on YouTube, truly fantastic. Do you have a transcript of it? Because if not, then I'm going to make one, because I find it very quotable in many places and want to be able to search it?
That's a good question. I'm glad it was helpful. I don't think a transcript exists. If it might make sense to email the, you know, someone who organized that summit to ask them that question. And if you're not, I don't know if you're in touch with anyone there. If you're not, I'm happy to send someone an email and ask, and then I can let you know based on the response that I get.
I'm not in touch with anyone, so if you do that, I'd really appreciate it.
All right, I'll send an email and let you know what I hear, and I really appreciate, you know, it's great to hear that was helpful, and I appreciate your offer to put that together for others.
Thanks so much.
Hey, Richard, quick question. Did you say 2013 or 2014?
2013. 2014 is not on YouTube, and I'm vaguely disappointed.
Okay, great.
To my knowledge.
Yeah, cool. All right, we're going to go back to Matt. Matt, with another question.
Yes, hi. I know that GiveWell before had done some research on the global catastrophic risks. One which I was sort of interested in is climate change, specifically the co-benefits around that. I know that there was a lot around sort of air quality issues being really significant in a lot of parts of the developing world, where you can do some climate stuff and it has a very significant health thing, because that's like one of the biggest, in terms of like DALI, that's one of the largest contributors. It's not the most cost effective, but it's like a big chunk of DALIs. So I was wondering if where GiveWell was planning on doing more research on that, what it has, like what are the plans for an investigation of that, or is that just sort of on the back burner compared to the other priorities?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Our climate change research is part of the Open Philanthropy Project. So it's kind of a very separate part of our work than everything we've been talking about thus far on the call. It's also something that I don't spend as much time on, so I'm not going to be able to answer your question really well. But I'll tell you what we've done and where we stand. So we've done what we call a shallow overview of climate change. This is, and I'll send this link through, this is kind of part of our approach in the Open Philanthropy Project work, where we just try to get a basic sense of the field, what the major issues are, who the major funders are, and whether it seems like this is an opportunity for us to sort of make a big difference. You know, then so from the page I linked through, there's, you know, there's other links that go into more detail about, you know, our views on, you know, what we could possibly do in climate change. Our basic, the very short summary of our perspective is that climate change is an area. Climate change is a problem that is like very, very large. And so if we were able to make a big difference in slowing or preventing climate change, that would have significant humanitarian benefits. But it is also an area that has significant funding from others, from other funders already there. And so it's kind of like harder to find the part of that question where we can be most productive or most useful. The single part of climate change that we have been most focused on recently and seems to be sort of the most promising from our perspective is an area called geoengineering, which is you know, the idea of geoengineering would be to do something to the climate proactively to cool the planet. That is clearly, like, would be extremely dangerous, and so you'd have to put a lot of thought into it before anything happened. But it's an area of climate change that appears to have virtually no funding available to it. And so we have looked more into geoengineering, in particular, into sort of funding discussion and thinking around the safe use of geoengineering. Like, if you were to want to implement this technology, like, one thing you can see going wrong is that, like, one country decides to do it, but other countries don't want it to do it, and that could cause some sort of global catastrophe beyond just the sort of catastrophe of climate change. And so what I think needs to be in place are mechanisms for reaching a global consensus or at least a reasonable judgment about how, when, and whether to use these technologies. And so that has been an area that we've been focused on recently. You know, one other thing is that our view is that, I think this is true. I hope I'm not overstating this, that, you know, the most likely negative impacts of climate change are not ones that we would characterize as global catastrophic risks. We'd characterize them as, you know, very negative and worth trying to avoid, you know, worth having like a carbon tax to reduce carbon emissions, but not like significantly affecting the trajectory of humanity. There's like a sort of a long tail of possible impacts, the sort of like very end of the spectrum of what could happen to the climate. Those are impacts that, you know, could be catastrophic. And so those are the ones that, you know, are also the ones that we think are most likely to be targeted by geoengineering. But, you know, this is, so you can sort of click around on our website. If you have more questions on this topic specifically, you're better off, you know, sort of sending us an email, because I'm not the person who spent most time on it. And there's other people here who are more up to date on what we're doing right now on it.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'll do that.
Great. Thanks. Okay. Well, any other questions? Just want to encourage you to shoot in while you're still here. If you have any, let me know. So any other last questions from the group here? It's really been a pleasure talking to you all. I really enjoyed this. I hope it was helpful. I really appreciate your spending some time on a weekend chatting about GiveWell. I know that, you know, most of what you see when you come to our website is, you know, long text reports, but we are like very happy to engage one-on-one and answer questions. The best thing to do is to shoot an email to info@givewell.org if you have questions, and folks here are happy to jump on the phone and chat. You know, even if you're just sort of trying to think through your giving decision and think we can be helpful, it's something we do and are really happy to do. And you know, we recognize that the, you know, the goal of the web content is to be accessible to anyone who's willing to spend the time to go through it. But we know it's not the easiest content to engage with and understand. And so we're really happy to, you know, have this type of conversation, but even if it would be helpful, one-on-one conversations. So, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out. And I just want to say that, you know, I personally, but, you know, everyone at GiveWell really appreciates, you know, your interest in our work. It's, you know, without people like you, it wouldn't make any sense for us to be doing the work that we're doing. And so I'm kind of like very appreciative that, you know, you all are so excited and interested in what we're doing. So no other questions have come in. So I guess we'll wrap up the call here. Thanks again for your participation, and I hope to hear from you again in the future. Best of luck with your giving decisions this year. Bye.